and a happy new year.
In jail.
That's right.
I wanted to let the music run out on its own for this, our last ever episode of the No Lame Life.
No.
Of 2014.
Of 2014.
That's right. Did I make you nervous? Did you think for a moment that I was going to abandon you and quit this podcast forever and go off and become a famous podcaster with some other better, more important, more successful podcast?
You and what army of podcasters?
What if I, what, you don't know if I've been entertaining offers, though.
They can have
maybe you think maybe
they can
you
have
think,
you is my response to any offers that you get.
Maybe they think maybe you think that I've just been doing nothing this December but making Christmas perfect for you, which I did. Maybe that's all you know about my activities this month. Maybe you don't know that all the famous podcasts have been clamoring for me.
I wish you all the luck with that and all my best wishes for your future.
It could happen.
On other shows.
It could happen. I could. What if I became the star of the of us instead of you?
Well, I got
currently you are the star.
You're
of
certainly
us.
Trying by talking over me and elbowing me out of the way whenever possible. You're gonna throw some rhinestones on a staircase and I'm not looking. No me Malone.
Gay.
This is a podcast of the cinema.
Yes, named Linoleum Knife.
Yes.
Featuring me. My name is Dave White. I'm the film critic of movies.com and starring the star, Alonzo Duralde, who's the shining Christmas star.
Shut up.
Of the star-filled starland.
In the cinematic firmament.
Yes. I mean, really, if you think about it, I know I goof all the time about being, like, the star of the show. And you being my sidekick. But if we measure the numbers, you have, like, thousands more
social
media people than I do. You do.
We're a duo.
Deeply influential in the world of cinema opinions.
We're a duo like Wallace and Davis.
You get quoted in things all the time. I get ignored.
Well, again, so, I think that's about venue. I think if you were writing for The Wrap and I was writing for movies.com, you would get more quoted.
It doesn't matter. You're the boss.
No, shut up. Don't humble brag yourself into me complimenting you. This is a duet. What a wild...
You see through all my tricks.
What a wild duet.
I was just trying to get you to praise me.
But they're husbands.
Well, they're not identical husbands.
I wasn't going to say that.
Although there's that time the lady and Brooks Brothers thought we were brothers.
Right.
Are y'all brothers?
Are y'all brothers?
This is in Dallas, back in the 90s. Are y'all brothers? No.
Not in the
slightest. He's my boyfriend. In fact, we just got fake married.
That's right. Yeah, we had our ring.
Because it's the 90s and gay marriage won't be legal for another nearly 20 years.
Right.
I see this in the future.
Which it will.
In
our future seeing, we thought it was going to be after we were dead.
Yeah.
So it's been kind of a stunning ride.
And she goes, y'all ain't boyfriends. I was like, yeah, we are. Here are the rings.
Yes.
Look, the ring has his name inside of it. It's on my finger.
And mine, coincidentally,
is on
has
your,
his name.
Correct.
Of it.
That equals
not
that
brothers.
Equals Doggy and Kitty Wedding of 1997. And so, yeah, you saw through my trick of trying to self-deprecate to get you to praise me.
Yeah, not biting on that line, fisherman.
It'll never happen again.
Thank you. So we are going to wrap up the year's movies for the most part. There's still actually some releases still squeezing in on the 31st, which we'll get to next time, as well as a couple of films that someone hasn't seen yet.
As I recently announced...
Yes, you were making Christmas
I was very busy making Christmas perfect for you. And wasn't it?
And it was pretty perfect.
Yeah.
It was a great Christmas.
Yeah. Who got the Clue novelization in his Christmas stocking?
I did.
That's right.
From you.
Who searched months and months and months on the internet to look for a copy of that book that didn't cost 50 to $200.
You did.
Because that's what jerks want for that book.
Oh, I know.
All y'all that have a copy of that book trying to sell it for that kind of money, you jerks. I mean, get that money if you can get it. I mean, maybe there's somebody rich out there that wants to.
There is supply and demand out there.
But if you, but by making me have to work harder for it, they're jerks.
So yeah, so we'll be getting to the there's a couple movies that are out now that we'll be getting to later. There's a couple movies opening next week that we'll get to next time. And because the first couple of weeks in January tend to be slow and dull, we'll be doing all of our top 10, you know, worst 10 action then. So this week,
fine.
This week being the
are we gonna have wait? So I have to make a list, is what you're saying?
Yes.
I don't wanna.
You should make one. And you should...
They're dumb.
Frankly, you should have made one already and put it on our website.
Lists are dumb. The lists, the end of the year lists are dumb.
People click on them.
I don't care.
Well, it's not like it's a listicle, it's a list.
I know. I'm not thinking of it in terms of a listicle. I'm just thinking about it in terms of the presumption.
People like to know at the end of the year what other people thought about the year.
No, film critics like to hear themselves announce things.
No, trust me, of our young fan base who contact us on Facebook and stuff, yeah. I get asked about lists all the time. I get asked about
stop asking lists. About lists. Young
I get
people.
Asked about lists from years past when I didn't even make a list because I wasn't reviewing for anybody.
Mm.
It's like, sorry, no list. So, yeah, you're gonna make lists, and you're gonna like it.
Well, they're gonna be guests.
We should get
talking
guests.
About
we
the
should
list.
Totally get guests.
All right,
we've done that in the past, and it's always been entertaining.
Yeah, we'll do that maybe too.
Poor you. You have to put so much effort into this show.
This.
You have to sit down at a microphone that I have set up for you. And record a program that I post online.
Yes. 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 Yes.
Shall we call the Wambulance to
I love,
pick you up?
Look, I love doing this show. I love being on this show. The show that you forced me to be on. So you, all those years ago.
You love it.
I love being on this show. I just hate having to do extra work and make lists because, yeah. I am philosophically opposed to the best of and worst of list. I just am. And if no one's forcing me to do one.
Well, I
like
am.
My own website didn't ask me to do one because they never do. But a couple of the other editors at the site decided that they were just going to do one of their own.
I saw.
And I was like, okay, sure, cool, whatever.
I saw other people.
I do not care.
Here's the thing. Look, at the end of the year, people look back at, you know, the news and at the events of the year. And you saw more movies than most civilians did over the last 12 months. So, as such, your opinion on what were the best of those movies and which were the worst is of interest.
Equal value to any nerd.
And allows people, when a best list, think of all the people who go, oh, what's this Stray Dogs movie? I haven't heard of that. I'll have to go
There's
check
a reason
that
you
out.
Haven't heard of it.
Oh, what's this... El Norte movie.
Yeah.
Is it El Norte?
That's the other problem. That's the other problem. My list is going to basically be stuff that no one has seen.
And no one would expect any less from you.
And
Dave Turrenhorse White.
And I don't... I feel like by making a list like that, I feel like I'm trying to out-snoot everybody.
Well, you will, and you are.
I'm not trying to do that,
Please,
though. I just know what I like.
You're going to have 9 Estonian silent films and a movie where Adam Sandler eats his own poop.
Wait, did he do that?
It's on his to-do list.
Did he do that in a movie?
He did not get to that yet.
Because if he would do that in a movie...
Give him time.
If there were 90 minutes of him eating his own poop... That would be hilarious.
I'm not even going to pursue this line of inquiry any further.
It would be the ultimate Adam Sandler film.
I'm sorry I brought it up in the first place.
He could retire forever.
Forgive me,
having
listeners.
Reached the pinnacle of Adam Sandler-ishness.
But he's never going to be that cool.
And he would have out-divined Divine.
Well, exactly. That's why he's never going to be that cool.
And
he's no Divine.
And then we could all be done with him. Mm. Also, he might get very sick. But...
That's his whole
life. I sure would watch that.
You would. So yeah, so that's coming up in weeks to come, listeners. But for now, we have five movies.
Yeah.
Because we already talked about The Interview last week with our guest Leonard Maltin. And yeah. If you missed that episode, good gravy, go back and listen to
gravy.
It. Because Leonard Maltin was on this show.
Yeah, he was.
And he was just stunning.
He's better than us.
He is. We admit it. He is a class act all the way. And he, you know, elevated this program with his mere presence.
He wasn't taking... Here's the funny thing about... I listened to part of that episode. No matter what I did to goad him, he refused to play along. Like, he did not take any outlandish bait from me.
He's too smart for you.
No matter what I would say, there'd be this little pause, and he'd go, very well. And then...
Okay.
Okay, Dave. As it, like, sort of, are you finished talking now, Dave?
The grown-ups are not having a conversation. Anyway, so we talked about the interview, which it turns out you get to see after all of that to-do and foo-for-aw and higgledy-piggledy and hurly-burly. So, yeah. So it's out there in the world. It is on your computer right now.
And, all right, so what are the movies?
Well, let's start with Into the Woods. What the heck?
Okay. I wish we... There. I just, that was my End of the Woods impersonation.
I'm a fan of this.
More than anything.
More than life. I'm a fan of the show going way back. Dave had never seen it until I sat him down about a month ago.
I knew some of the songs.
To watch the PBS thing. Well, we had seen Into the Woods Jr.
We had seen Into the Woods Jr.
Starring Ms. Kate Smeal.
Yes.
As the witch. She was stunning.
She was.
She was 11 at the time. She's now a lady.
Into the Woods Jr. is the one they do in middle schools where...
It's the first half.
It's the first half.
And
you were not alone.
And no one is alone, yeah.
Yeah. Or no one is alone.
Yeah.
And that's a great way for kids to do that show. But it would be so cool
if they did the whole thing.
If the middle school kids did the whole thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. That would be the way they would do it. In that movie Camp, which I know is already your DVD pick of the week.
Yeah, well, thanks for spoiling
it. I ruined it.
Yes.
The, so, all right, Meryl Streep is the witch.
Right.
Taking over for,
Kate Smeal.
Bernadette Peters and Kate Smeal.
And Vanessa Williams and Felicia.
Kate Smeal, who is now approximately 24 or 5. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's not like, she's not still 11.
No.
But
her stage presence in that role burns into the memory.
It did. It was highly memorable.
She was great.
Meryl Streep's the witch, and she is, she placed a curse on the baker and the baker's wife, and the baker is James Corden, and the baker's wife is Emily Blunt, who is fantastic in this. And the curse is that their family tree is barren because the baker's father cheated the witch out of the greens in her garden. And the witch tells the baker and the baker's wife that in order to break the curse, they have to go get Little Red Riding Hood's cape, Cinderella's slipper, Jack of Jack and the Beanstalk fame's cow, and some of Rapunzel's hair.
Well,
some blonde hair.
The cape is red as blood, the cow is white as milk, the slipper is pure as gold, and the hair is yellow as corn. She doesn't specify whose they have to be.
Right. But that's what they end up
having. Conveniently enough,
this is the universe where all the fairy tales are happening at the same time.
Right.
And so, so they go off and they get the stuff. And what you realize about the wishes of people in fairy tales is that they are inherently selfish, just like everyone else's wishes in life, in the world.
They're short-sighted.
Are also selfish and self-serving. And they will do whatever it takes to get the thing they want.
Right.
And when they feel like they have had their happy ending, they forget that the consequences of some of their actions lead to even worse predicaments, such as a very giant giant stomping people to death.
Yes.
Main characters included.
Yes.
So death stalks them throughout. And that is a metaphor for life.
And it's a musical.
Death is death at one's elbow.
Yes.
Always. And the and it's a musical. And it's all singing. Yeah. More or less. I mean, there's very little...
There's a narrator that speaks in prose. But
and most of the spoken dialogue is rhymey. Or at least that's my memory.
Well, it's when it's sung, yes.
Yeah. So, which was a surprise to my sister-in-law.
Apparently so.
I don't know if my older brother listens to this show or not, but apparently my sister-in-law, he posted about it on Facebook.
Yeah.
His wife went to see it with her daughter, and they came home singing their everyday dialogue, apparently sort of mocking the film because they didn't realize going in that everything was sung and that Sondheim's musicality is not immediately catchy.
Mm.
It requires attention to be paid, and it requires sort of second and third listenings.
This is your brother who thought that Wicked was awesome.
I told him.
Not that there's anything wrong with Wicked.
He texts me, he's like, I saw Wicked. And I was like, right. I said, and the countdown to you turning into a homosexual is in 3, 2, 1. And he says, what are you talking about? Have I already told this story on this show before?
I don't remember.
I may have. If I have, forgive me, people who've, both of you who heard me tell the story before. He's like, what's gay about Wicked? I was like, I don't know. Everything.
It's a stage musical based on The Wizard of Oz.
I haven't even seen Wicked, and I know this. I went to a gay wedding where the friggin' song
Defying Gravity.
Was that they sang before the vows was Defying Gravity.
I'm really glad I wasn't
there. It was a gay wedding by some gays who are my friends.
Yes. But still,
who I think are wonderful.
I love them. I would have had a hard time not laughing.
Well, here's why I didn't
at
laugh.
At a gay wedding where Defying Gravity.
Here's why I did not laugh, because I didn't know what song it was.
Mm-hmm.
Only after the fact did I know. Because I heard the song and I was like, what's this Gravity song? What is happening? And then after it was over, I went home and looked it up. Because I got a snippet of the lyrics.
Right.
I went home and Googled it, and I was like, oh, that's from Wicked. That must be a popular song from Wicked. And then I learned after the fact, like, suddenly, you know how you hear a word that you've never heard before?
And then it's everywhere.
And then it's everywhere. Like, apparently that song was already everywhere, and I didn't know it.
Defying Gravity was Let It Go before Let It Go was Let It Go.
I guess. And
we have Idina Menzel to blame for all of this.
So completely homosexual-ish at its core is Wicked.
Yeah.
So I taunted my brother for a while after that.
Yeah, his wife was not having the the musicality of this musical.
And I just wonder, like, I don't know, has she ever seen a Sondheim anything? Is that a new thing?
It is quite possible.
Because I mean, that's the kind of songs he makes. They sound like,
unless she saw Sweeney Todd,
they sound foreign to your ears at first.
Unless she saw Sweeney Todd, I would imagine that your sister-in-law has quite possibly never seen a Sondheim.
I don't know. West Side Story.
He didn't write the music.
True.
Leonard Bernstein did.
That is correct. But it's still Sondheim.
Lyrically, yes.
I understand.
He wrote the lyrics for Gypsy and West Side Story, but then after that is when he became a singer, a composer and lyricist.
Right.
Anyway, so...
This movie.
So it's the End of the Woods movie.
This movie.
Santa Claus. No. This movie is mostly works, I think. I had a few issues with it. I think that it has some Disney thumbprints on it that are kind of annoying. Like, if you know the show, Rapunzel just sort of exits stage right before anything bad happens.
Right.
Because, you know, Tangled 3. And then there's also...
Well, has there been a Tangled?
There's already been a Tangled 2.
Where was that?
To DVD.
Oh, okay. Well, then it doesn't count.
Same voices.
Still doesn't count.
It counts.
No.
In the Disney universe, it counts. Okay, let me put it this way. If they put another Tangled movie in theaters, they're not going to call it Tangled 2 because there already is one.
They're going to call it Tangled colon blah 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 blah.
Exactly.
Right.
But there is a movie
And they'll skip over whatever information we were supposed to get. There is a movie called
Tangled 2.
Because there ain't no way I'm ever going to go watch Tangled 2.
No, well, anyway. Yeah. Anyway, Rapunzel, you know, very conveniently sort of shunted off. The agony reprise taken out, I think, purely to keep Snow White and Sleeping Beauty
out of the
pure
picture.
Of this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Also, it is directed by Rob Marshall, who
is a director I do not like.
Well, I thought Chicago was fine.
It was fine.
It was fine. And it introduced us to what turns out to be his signature directing style for musicals, which is hella claustrophobic.
Right, up the nose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which worked in Chicago because, you know, it's all taking place inside of Renee Zellweger's imagination to some extent. Boy, did it not work in 9, where you're just trapped inside Chinechita for 3 hours.
I don't remember a single thing about 9. And I saw it, and I reviewed it. And the minute I was done writing about it, I thought, I never have to think about this film again.
There's a terrible, terrible number with Fergie in it.
Here's
a shockingly good number with Kate Hudson.
I remember thinking, Kate Hudson, right on.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the shocker.
The star of Raising movie. Helen.
And I
can all and, be happy for her now.
And I remember thinking that, you know, the discussion we've had about actresses with anachronistic faces.
Yes.
I remember thinking both Nicole Kidman and Sophia Loren did not look like they belonged in the 1960s.
Well, yeah.
But yeah, for the most part. The other thing I remember about that, about 9, is the fact that the lead character's name is Guido Contini.
Yeah.
And you could have a drinking game for the number of times that people say, Guido Contini! In that movie.
That's a cool name to say.
Like, they say it in the middle of songs. It's nuts.
It's akin to Alonso Duraldi.
Yeah, well, I guess. Anyway, so in Into the Woods, it's similarly claustrophobic, despite the fact that the movie is almost entirely taking place outside.
Right.
And it's not claustrophobic in a way of like, oh, we're encroached upon by these woods. It's more kind of like, oh, we don't have a very large set to play with here.
It just feels
kind of
as though
airless.
He decided that because the problems taking place are these sort of interior human problems, psychological problems.
And because the characters keep running into each other.
Fear, you know, that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. Regret. That a decision was made to not make it a very big-looking movie, to make it a small-looking movie. But then what you have are numbers where 5 people are singing at the same time. And the camera cuts back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to them instead of just filling the frame, filling a large frame with all these people singing together. No.
Well, you know,
cut, 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 cut. Medium shot.
Yeah.
Close up on the face. Like,
the agony number feels liberating because you can see the sky and they're actually sort of like next to a waterfall and you get the feeling, oh, we're outside now.
I don't want to crap on it too hard because I actually like it.
No, I like it a lot.
Reason I like it is its thematic maturity.
Yes.
The songs are so great. And the performances are good.
Yeah, no.
Like,
absolutely.
All across the board. And I know you didn't like the kids, but I did like the kids.
I didn't dislike the girl who played Little Red Riding Hood. I thought that she was miscast because she plays it off too young.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the character has to be a little more pubescent because there's the sexual undercurrent of her encounter with the wolf. I didn't like the guy who played Jack.
You're being yelled at on the internet. Excuse me for yawning. I'm not bored by you yet. Yelled at on the internet by people. Well, not just one guy. Who are taking you to task for the fact that the stage show, the Broadway stage
version. Yes, the girl was 13 and this actress was 13.
Same age as the girl.
But again, that's...
But she plays it older.
Exactly. Yeah. That's not the point.
Yeah.
As Jack, they cast the kid who played Gavroche in Les Miserables,
and I can't stand that kid. You hate that kid.
He's terrible. He overacts.
He's listening now, and you're bullying him.
No, I'm sorry. He is...
What if he listens to this podcast? You're a bully.
No, I'm not bullying. I'm reviewing. He sings to the back balcony when the camera is 2 feet away. He is constantly auditioning for Newsies.
Who can kill a child? Alonso Duraldi.
I can critique a child. He's constantly auditioning for Newsies. I can't stand him. And he does the same thing here. It drives me nuts. Also, he's too young as well, because there's an element of sexual awakening to the character that doesn't take place, or that can't take place because the character's too young and it just doesn't play. And right. The character doesn't change at all because he's already, you know,
right.
Gung-ho and, you know, oh, you kid from the beginning, you know. He's like Mickey Rooney or something.
Oh, you kid.
You know what I mean.
Yes, I do. And so do all the other people born in 1927.
He's gee whiz from the get-go, you know. The character's kind of an idiot, frankly, who matures a bit over the course of the story. This is all nitpicking. The movie is a lot of fun to watch.
The second act, I think, is it has the best... It should weigh the most.
Uh-huh.
But it's sort of a little unbalanced.
Well, I mean, the show is always, you know, the first part is fun and
bigger and longer.
And zippy, and things are intertwining. Yeah, and then the second act is like, the consequences of
right.
it all. But the songs are still really great throughout. The performances, like you said, are terrific. Emily Blunt absolutely
walks away with this. In particular, Emily Blunt is terrific.
But I thought that Anna Kendrick and Meryl Streep were terrific. Johnny Depp
he's fine.
There's just enough of him that you don't get sick of him. It's
right.
one
he's
scene.
Gone. He's gone.
Yeah,
don't
he's
worry.
In and out.
He doesn't ruin anything.
James Corden is fine.
Which seems to be his job now.
Ruining movies.
Wrecking everything. Yeah. Used to be that he was like the MVP.
Yeah.
And now you're just like, could you just, I need a vacation from you.
Yeah, he needs to do an Anne Hathaway and like take a couple of years away and let us.
Did she take a couple of years
she
away?
Did,
I don't
yeah.
know that she did.
After Les Miserables, she kind of went away for a while. Think what have you seen her in?
Was
lately?
She did she go away or did she just work and stay out of the prep? Stay out of the papers.
I think both. But basically, just like okay, you've all had it. I'm going to give you time to miss me and then I'll come back. You know, we need to miss Johnny Depp because Lordy,
right.
Yeah, James Corden is fine. It's Tracy Ullman, you know, briefly. It's a lot of fun and I like it a lot, and I think if you know and love the Stage Musical, you'll enjoy it. And if you don't, this is as good a way as any to be introduced to it. But then after
I was newish to it, other than like I say, You Are Not Alone. No one is alone or whatever it's called.
And also I had
staple of gay men's choruses everywhere.
True. Also, I showed you the Broadway version
that
was on PBS that just came out on Blu-ray before we saw this. After you see this movie, you might want to go dig that version up as well.
Because it's pretty good.
It's terrific, and it has songs that aren't in the movie. So, So Into the Woods. I was rather pleased. Shall we do a word from our sponsor?
Oh, yeah. Pause it for a second while I dig it up. All right, this is a commercial by us. Well,
for us.
For us. I'm okay. Linoleum Knife is brought to you by The Real Truth, REEL. Everything you didn't know you needed to know about making an independent film by Reed Martin. He gets his own title right this time.
Yes, he does.
Last time, he was gaslighting me.
He was trying to make it
and then you were telling me I was wrong.
But he didn't tell me in advance he was doing that, so I was like, what's happening here?
This is one of the few books on independent film production that tells you like it is from some of the top filmmakers you know and love, but also includes interviews with dozens of indie film studio executives. With the Sundance Film Festival coming up, you're going.
I am?
I'm not. Again.
You're not.
I've never been to Sundance. I never want to go to Sundance. Everything you've ever told me about going to Sundance seems like a disaster to me.
It's not that bad.
It sounds horrible.
It would be fun to go with you.
No. Don't you have to take like a hang glider or something to get from the airport to the Sundance?
You fly a real big boy plane into Salt Lake City, and then you take a van to Salt. To
oh, it's a van.
City, yeah.
It's not a tiny little.
No, no Aaliyah planes.
No planes like that. Those are not good planes. I don't have to be on a plane. I don't want to be on a plane.
You would just be to Salt Lake City.
It just seems no. What's happening? The Sundance Film Festival is
coming
up.
You say.
reading The Real Truth with the Sundance Film Festival coming up is almost like sitting down with dozens of today's leading film executives, which is a thing that you will never do
at the
Sundance, Film Festival. Here's why. They're getting into things you're not. And I know this from hearing you talk about it, too. You wind up in the Levi's gifting suite watching jerks come in and get their gift bags. And then you call home and you're like, this is a drag.
That was just one time.
I want to come home.
Every other Sundance I've had a lovely time.
So you should read this book instead of going to the Sundance Film Festival. Here are some of the people in this book that you will not meet at the Sundance Film Festival, even though they will be there.
Well, unless you are Justin Simien and your movie is hot, hot,
unless you're Justin Simien and everyone loves you now, yes.
Yes.
Which is earned.
Yes.
Because Dear White People is groovy.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy Utley, president of Fox Searchlight, distributor of Birdman, and the Reese Witherspoon film Wild. Nancy discusses what kind of marketing materials you need to create along the way during the production phase, so you're not having to scramble at the last minute after your film is completed.
Okay.
You don't want to finish your movie and then walk around like
trying to fake production stills.
With your finger in your nose, being like, oh no, what do I do now? I guess I just have my friends talk about it at the grocery store. Hey, everybody, go to the produce section and start talking about my movie. That would be how I did it, probably.
Probably. That's how you promote this podcast.
This basically, yeah, I do. I go to where the organic oranges are, and I'm like, have y'all heard about linoleum knife?
It's great.
It's as good as these organic oranges. Cassian Elways,
mm-hmm.
Is that how you say that name? Producer of the Dallas Buyers Club and Lee Daniels' The Butler, will tell you about the thought processes that name actors go through before deciding to appear in a low-budget indie film, such as, why ain't I getting paid any money? And Eamon Bowles, or is it Eamon?
Eamon.
Eamon Bowles of Magnolia Pictures, which distributed Force Majeure, We Are the Best, and the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself, talks about what's wrong with most indie film business plans that filmmakers write to raise money for their projects. All of this and how not to screw up your first film in 100 different ways can be found in The Real Truth, Everything You Didn't Know That You Needed to Know About Making an Independent Film by Reed Martin from Faber and Faber Publishers.
Yes, sir.
Also, Reed Martin, thank you for the Grant Hart documentary that you sent us via the internet. I will watch it because I was a big Husker Du fan in the 80s when I was punk rock. And I'm still punk rock.
Well, now you're punk rock and old.
I'm just super old now. If you were punk rock in the 80s, you are automatically super old now.
Yes, but being not dead means that you are cooler than the people who...
Well, I mean, the alternative, yeah, to being super old is to be dead.
Right.
Yeah, I prefer super old to that.
My point exactly.
So I get to watch the Husker Du Grant Hart documentary. Right.
So, Reed Martin, thank you for your support of this program throughout 2014 and hopefully going into 2015 as well.
Yes. All right. American Sniper.
Yeah. The second film this year from director Clint Eastwood.
The first was Jersey Boys.
Yes. This one...
is not the garbage that Jersey Boys was.
No. No, it is not. It is, however, problematic in a whole different way.
I wish... more than anything...
more than life.
that I had... all right. I walked into this film knowing jack
diddly squat
about Chris Kyle.
Right.
I didn't even know that he was dead. I thought, well, he wrote American Sniper with two ghostwriters, and I just figured, well, that guy's out there somewhere still. Look at that dude. He looks just like Bradley Cooper. I mean, I looked him up, mm-hmm. but I just saw his face. And I thought, all right, well, they cast the right guy to play you because Bradley Cooper kind of looks like you. And you must be out there non-sniping now. Just writing books with ghostwriters. No, he's dead. He was killed at a firing range by a fellow veteran with PTSD.
Right.
Who kind of...
flipped out.
Flipped out that day and shot Chris Kyle.
Yes.
Shot him dead.
Some have questioned the logic of taking a veteran.
Well, but that's no. That's a thing.
Two-way firing. No, well, it's a It's a thing when it's supervised and when it's sort of when a doctor says it's a good idea.
I didn't know doctors say
it was.
They're
not necessarily sure that that happened.
Well,
that
may have just been either way. That's not the point.
No.
I did not know really anything about Chris Kyle. I didn't know how good his book was, although my younger brother was really into reading this book.
I could see that.
And I remember it being recommended to me by him. And so I didn't know that the book contained stuff that makes him a somewhat less sympathetic as a person
than the movie does.
It
also contains an account of a fight with Jesse Ventura.
Is that in the book?
It's in the book, and Jesse Ventura sued and won.
Yeah, he won a defamation suit, and apparently the thing he... Now, did he say in the book? Are we sure he said it
in
the book?
Book, yes.
You know this.
Yes.
All right.
That is not in the film.
All right, yeah. Every one of this man's flaws have been stripped out of the film.
Yeah.
I saw the film not knowing these things. Mm. I saw the film thinking that this was a very sort of stripped down story about a guy who has a talent at being a sniper, becomes the most accomplished killer of human beings with a rifle
during the Iraq War.
And who, you know, admittedly suffers psychologically from that experience. Right. Comes home, he's a little damaged from the war, perhaps a lot damaged. The bulk of the movie is him voluntarily returning for tour after tour after tour, while his wife, played by Sienna Miller, becomes increasingly upset about this choice on his part. He finally kind of has had enough. He comes home, he's messed up. And then I'd say maybe the final 15 minutes, maybe final 10 to 12 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Starts getting his life together by helping other veterans.
Yeah, gets his life together by helping other veterans. And then in the final 10 seconds, we learn... One of those veterans kills him.
Yes.
And this is communicated to us via title cards.
Yeah.
I feel like, not counting the other problems that we will talk about in a moment, I feel like it is a narratively unbalanced movie.
Well, yeah, we'll be talking about Unbroken shortly. And again, it's a movie where there's an interesting facet of this person's life that the movie is not interested in telling you about.
Right.
That either like Unbroken, it skips entirely and just tells you about it in the closing credits, or in this movie, they just zip through it. And not just even zip through it, but they zip through it to the extent where suddenly there's even a scene where Sienna Miller's like, wow, honey, you're doing so much better now.
It's so great that you're better now.
And it's like, what, in the last 30 seconds? Like, when did that happen?
I mean, I guess people could be complaining to you and me right now that we're sort of giving things away.
It's based on a true story.
But it's based on a true story. It's historical. It's recent history. It was all over the news. Yeah. So,
it's
not like it's a secret.
Right.
Unless you're dumb like me and you didn't know anything.
When you talk about your take on the film based on not having known the book or the story or whatever.
I thought it was fine.
It reminds me of my take on Lone Survivor last year.
Yes.
Which I saw as this powerful kind of anti-war statement. And then later found out, no, it was based on a book that was very popular among Fox News Nation, basically, about how, isn't it great that we're in Afghanistan, and, So, yeah, I mean, it's...
They are films made to court both sides of the fence.
This is an aggressively non-political film when it comes to the wars. Like, there's maybe a few fleeting lines of dialogue from other characters of, oh, perhaps this is a waste of time.
The worst you can say about this character, based on what you see in the film, is that he's not incredibly thoughtful about his time there. He is a simple man who...
He is doggedly patriotic without
thinking about it. And wants to serve his country regardless of how or why that's happening.
Eastwood even suggested he's basically very easily swayed by things he sees on TV news.
Yes.
Because he joins the Navy in the first place because of a bombing of like the embassy in Tanzania.
Yes.
And then it's seeing the 9/11 footage that then spurs him on to whatever the next thing is. And it's like, it was weird to see that scene twice. It just kind of felt like, wow, what happens when an infomercial comes
out? But in general, it is pulled way back on
the politics.
On the politics. And so as I watched it, I thought, okay, well, this sort of feels like a piece with Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima, where it's about soldiers doing their jobs.
Right.
And it doesn't have a context for, saying that they did the right thing or the wrong thing. And in that reading it that way, I thought this was a fine movie that rushed itself at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I should have done a lot more homework going in. I don't know.
I was the same way.
I rely on a movie to be a movie and teach me what it needs to teach me within the context of the movie.
Exactly. I was fairly kind to it on What the Flick, but the more I hear about this guy and his actual story, and the more I think the other stuff, the other issues at stake here, it annoys me more and more. I mean, because even in the case of,
it makes the critical
like,
process very difficult.
Yes, because, in the case of Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima, for one thing, World War II... that's the war that everybody gives a pass to.
It's right.
No one... And even if it takes...
Well, they do know.
Well, exactly.
Right.
Again, those movies were made 60 years later.
Yeah.
Like, we still have troops in the Middle East.
Yes.
And to make a movie now that's sort of blithely apolitical, I don't think you can really get away with. Because, frankly, to be apolitical about the Iraq War is to be supportive of the Iraq War. Is that fair?
I guess it is. I wanted to give Mr. Eastwood the benefit of the doubt.
Sure.
Because I think he's a great director. And Jersey Boys notwithstanding.
Yeah.
And so I... Oh, also the rubber baby. Notwithstanding the rubber baby in this movie. There's a scene where... He could have done a second take. There's a scene where Bradley Cooper... is holding his baby child, and it is a prop baby with a stiff arm. And the more he moves it, and the stiff arm just moves. And I'm like, come on, rubber baby.
They could have turned that baby into Rocket Raccoon.
Loosen
it would have been more realistic.
I know, yeah. So so now y'all look for a rubber baby because it's in there. A week ago, I thought this was a fine film. Fine. Not great, not bad. Mm-hmm. Fine.
Serviceable.
Way better than Jersey Boys, and that's all I really wanted it to be.
That's a low bar.
But now the more I hear, I think, okay, this is a screwed up movie, and I don't know what I'm supposed to think anymore about this guy, because he clearly did the thing he thought was best his whole life.
It's not that you can't make a movie.
And he was
about
a human being with flaws, and he made mistakes, and he did some things that were admittedly not good. In terms of the way he treated people like Jesse Ventura.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't have bothered me. Like, I like a movie where someone's flaws are on display.
Sure.
It makes me like them more.
But if you're gonna make the movie about the person, make an honest movie about the person, or make something up, maybe he doesn't have to be named Kim Jong-un, Maybe I'm just saying, like, if you're going to make a movie about Chris Kyle, either make a movie about Chris Kyle or make a movie about this person that you want to tell a story about who is a fabrication.
Right.
And call him something else and borrow elements of Chris Kyle's story to tell that story,
Hey. So, now, Cooper's fine.
Yeah.
Very stoic through the entire thing. He gained a lot of weight.
Yes.
To be in it. Gained a...
And that's important acting.
Fairly solid Texas accent.
It is good. I buy it. I shockingly buy it. Sienna Miller's even.
Yeah, sort of West Texas-y kind of accent.
Which surprises me.
He's from Odessa or Midland, one of those places.
I think so, yeah.
It looks really good.
Yeah, the sniper stuff is interestingly set up. There's like this dust storm at the end that's kind of cool. I said this on What the Flick. It's not that the stuff that they show here are cliched necessarily, but the director comes up with a new way to shoot, like, street fighting in the Middle East is going to blow us all away. Because if you've watched Homeland and you've watched The Hurt Locker and you've watched, like, all these movies, you kind of know exactly the geographical layout,
yeah,
which shots you're going to get.
Yeah.
You know, it's again, it's not a cliche necessarily, but there's definitely sort of a pro forma method of doing this at this point.
Yes.
You know, in all the time that we've spent fighting over there. So since I mentioned Unbroken, we might as well segue into that, which is also a war picture, in a way.
Louis Zamperini.
Right.
I've explained the first two films you talk about.
Okay, fine. Yeah. So Louis Zamperini, child of Italian immigrants growing up in Southern California, was a bit of a juvenile delinquent, and then his brother, okay, was a total juvenile delinquent.
He was a flamboyant juvenile delinquent. He was really good at being a juvenile delinquent.
And I'm just noticing one of my knobs has been down, so I may have been quieter than I should have been on this episode.
Oh, really?
Yes. See how you dominate me.
Have you ruined everything?
No, it's fine. Look, I'm a bullhorn. No one missed my voice,
right.
I assure you.
All right.
Anyway, his brother gets him into high school track. He becomes a track star, winds up going all the way to the Olympics in Berlin, the infamous, you know, Berlin Olympiad with, you know, Jesse Owens and Hitler and all that. And then...
And all that.
I was kind of hoping there would be a shot...
Say, hello, got some good Olympics going on here.
I was hoping there'd be a shot of Leni Riefenstahl running around with a camera, you know. Anyway, he winds up... Zamperini winds up going to war with the American Air Force. And the film opens with a scene in a bomber where he's like a tail gunner or something. And it's very immediate and very terrifying. And you really get the sense that the shell of those planes were not very thick. Bullets kind of just cut right through them like they were paper.
Yeah.
So after one dangerous mission, he's sent off on another one in a plane that's rather ramshackle. It gets shot down. He and two fellow crew members survive on a raft for something like 10 weeks.
47 days.
Oh, I thought it was like 70-something days.
According to the stuff I found online, 47 days.
Oh, okay. All right, so almost 7 weeks then. Yeah. They are then captured by the Japanese and sent to one prison camp after another one. And this one particularly sadistic camp officer tries to break Zamperini. But Zamperini...
The bird.
But Zamperini remains unbroken.
Unbroken.
And again, not a spoiler, because he died this year at the age of 97.
He was incredibly unbroken.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And so his life story was told in a book by Laura Hillebrand, who wrote Seabiscuit, which is an amazing book and makes me want to read Unbroken because she can write like anybody's business. I don't care about sports or horses or anything, but when I started reading Seabiscuit one day when I was sick, and it was a good thing that I had nothing else to do that day but lie in bed because I could not put it down. I read the whole thing cover to cover in one go. It was so good. So the film is basically, you know, it kind of veers toward the sadomasochistic because it's just this guy getting tortured in various different ways and standing up to it and fighting back and you know, enduring. It's shot by Roger Deakins. It's scored.
Boy, does it look good.
It's scored by Alexandre Desplat. I mean, it's the whole thing has a sheen of, you know.
It is a handsome film.
Exactly. It is a well-made, it is a grand production. It lacks a certain humanity because we know that he survives all this, that's kind of all he does is survive things. And then again, like we were saying as far as the end, we find out at the end of the film, within the closing credits, that he actually, after suffering a walloping case of PTSD, then went to Japan and basically had a forgiveness tour where he found all of his former captors except for the one, and like forgave them. And that's a fascinating story.
Yeah, it is.
That this movie could not be less interested in telling you.
The film, at the very beginning, nods to the idea of him being a man of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And then discards that. You never hear about it again until the end, when again the title cards explain to you that he lived out his life as this sort of deeply religious man who forgave everyone everything that they did to him. And then later you see footage of him as like a 90-whatever-year-old guy.
Running with the Olympic torch.
Running with the Olympic torch in Japan.
Yeah.
And the... which I find fascinating. Like, I would love to have seen a little bit of what that post-war life would have been like. But the movie isn't really interested in that. If anything, the religious aspect of this film involves visually treating him very much like a Christ-like figure.
Mm-hmm.
The ad, the poster.
You're always holding up that beam.
He's holding up a giant beam. It's very much a crucifixion. It's a suggestion of a crucifixion. This, everything that happens to him is a station of the cross. It's
the passion of the Louis Zamperini.
And I don't know why, again, it is this sort of unbalanced narrative where we get, you know, the guts, but not...
The humanity.
The stuff that happens after.
You made a really good observation about how, you know, after this whole setup of him being the juvenile delinquent, and being the, you know, this kind of operator type.
He was wily.
Yeah, exactly. You would think that that's exactly the kind of skills that would serve him well in this prisoner camp thing.
And apparently, in real life, it did.
They don't
touch
on that.
They had a lot of schemes and you know, trickery that they all employed together as a gang of prisoners. You don't see that stuff in the film.
I mean, and I sort of connected the dots between just the rigor of Olympic training and the physical suffering that he put together, but I don't know, the movie doesn't really even...
Yeah.
Doesn't connect those dots either. You're sort of left to piece that together on your own.
I think Angelina Jolie was very impressed with him personally and wanted to make a film that...
Was reverent.
That was incredibly reverent toward him. And I mean, I don't fault her for that. Like, that's a fine, you know, sentiment. It doesn't exactly make for the most exciting film.
Yeah, you could make a movie that honors its subject matter and still presents him as a human being.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Again, it is fine.
It is handsomely.
I'm sorry that I use that word so much. I find myself going back to that word often for films like this. I just ultimately what I end up saying about them is it's fine.
No, I mean it is
a bland word.
It is a well-made film in the way that they talk about the well-made play. You know, it all holds together. It is, you look at it as an object. It is clearly, you know, a great deal of effort has been placed into it, and it just, but it's just, it left me kind of cold. I frankly like her first film better that a lot of people, most people didn't see in the land of blood and honey.
All right, Selma.
Ah.
Which has only opened in, what, New York and Los Angeles?
I think so, at this point. Just a couple of markets, yeah.
It opens in January wide.
Yes.
Across the country.
When Oprah will be promoting it nonstop on her own television
network. And she should. It is fantastic.
It's real great.
Yeah.
It made my top 10 list at the Rap.
It is not. It is not a biopic of Martin Luther King.
No. If anything, it is... The movie to compare it to is Lincoln.
Yeah.
It's about a sliver of a great man's life, you know, through one very difficult and world-changing period.
It's about what happens after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the events leading up to the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Right.
And specifically, the march that King organized from Selma, Alabama, to Montgomery, Alabama.
Across the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Yes. And the resistance that they met before, during, after, every moment of every day.
But also among just the internal struggle within the movement. Like, most of these movies, it's sort of like, oh, the saintly black people and oh, the mean white people. Yeah. And here you have, like, there's...
And a couple nice white people so that white audiences can be like, I would have been like him!
Exactly, yeah. But here you have, you know, there are other black activists who think that this march is a bad idea, or that they should be in charge of it, or that, right. you know, whatever. Which is like any other political movement ever, you know. There's always infighting, and there's always factions that think that they should be in charge, or this should be done in this way, and, you know, so a lot of the sort of inside baseball of how the thing even came together is really fascinating. This movie has some of the most powerful moments I've experienced in a film all year.
Yes.
It's bracing in the way that watching The Nick was bracing in terms of the depiction of American racism, because, again, you get these movies like The Help that portray it like, well, there were some mean people, but then there were nice people, and of course you, audience members, would have been the nice people, you know?
Right.
And it's like, these films really portray it as, no. This was ingrained in society, this was in the culture, this was acceptable behavior, this was how people acted. And it just as a day-to-day thing, and that's horrifying to watch from this not all that far away perspective of 50 years later.
Not far away at all.
Yeah.
At all. When I was a little kid, I lived in a little town in New Hampshire. There was a black family in the town. It's a town of 4,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
It was a summer town where the population grew to like 40,000 in the summer. And then Labor Day, they all packed up and went home.
Right.
And we had a black family in the town. And our family was friends with them. But here's the weird thing. My father was completely racist. Absolutely, totally, thoroughly, completely racist, using all of the words that racist people use.
Mm-hmm.
Although his favorite TV show was Sanford and Son. And so he was this... My father was very complicated.
Clearly.
But one thing that he did... aside from Sanford and Son and this black family in our town that were our friends, when we would drive to, like, say, Boston to go, you know, Christmas shopping or something, like once a year, and we would drive through, you know, a black neighborhood to get to our destination, he would make us lock the doors of the car. He taught us to be scared of black people. And when you're 4, 5, you think, oh no, my father is telling me that these people are going to kill us. So I had better lock the door and hide under the window of the seat. And I'm 4, so I'm small enough to do that. But that is the lesson that you get taught by a racist parent.
Right.
And it's a lesson you have to extract from yourself later in life when you realize that you have been taught a lie by your actual parents.
Well, it's weird.
And so that's a weird thing. And that happened in my lifetime to me.
No, look.
I was born when this stuff was going down.
I grew up in the South, you know, when Lester Maddox was still around.
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of stuff. But it was weird because my parents were not born in this country, so
right.
it wasn't like they had been they living in Atlanta for generations,
right.
and you know,
right.
so yeah, it was. I mean, I knew it was going on around me, but at the same time, like, I had black friends at school.
Well, you didn't have parents that were informed by American racism.
Right.
You had immigrant parents,
exactly,
who didn't really think about that stuff.
Yeah,
you know, Europeans, their approach to this is this whole other take. But anyway. So yes, this is happening. This has happened in our lifetime. I know if you're a young listener, you're thinking, "Oh God, the old dudes are talking about history."
And stuff's happening.
The stuff that's happening
right now.
This movie is so incredibly timely.
I mean, I'm sure this movie's probably been in the pipeline for a while, but it almost feels like it's a direct response, if nothing else, to the Supreme Court deciding that the Voting Rights Act is this quaint thing we don't need anymore.
Yeah,
which.
Challenges
obviously
to the Voting
do.
Rights Act, all this, you know, police violence. And I tell you, in the movie, the police violence is incredibly brutal.
Yeah,
and
in your face.
And completely resonant because of what's happening right now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, and what has always been happening. See,
right.
that's the thing. This stuff has always been happening. It's just now
like
in the news, and white people are paying attention to it.
I saw it with Bibbs, and on the way out, he said, yeah. "Wow!" And the timing couldn't be better. I mean, because there's just all these things happening. I said, sadly, the timing couldn't have been better in any time in the last 20 years.
Yes.
There would have been something that had just happened that this movie would address. You know,
so it's in terms of it, it's filmmaking. This is really good filmmaking.
Yeah.
As well, it feels alive in ways that historical drama rarely feels.
Yeah.
It feels it's immediate and it's raw and it's painful and it's incredibly watchable. It's not homework.
Yeah, no, this isn't a civics lesson, and this isn't like it just came off of the side of Mount Rushmore.
And here's why it's cool that it was directed by a woman. Ladies, 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 all throughout this film. The women are in the frame. It's not a bunch of dudes doing things and the women are at home worried. Yeah. The women are there. Tessa Thompson, who is the female lead in
Dear White People,
she plays one of the activists. They call her, in the film, they just call her an agitator. And, and those are her friends calling her an agitator. And in a film directed by a dude, that character would be introduced and then shoved off to the side. But she gets to talk. She's in the frame. Mm. If King is talking, she's standing right there. Ava DuVernay puts women in the frame. She's got a scene where Betty Shabazz and Coretta Scott King are talking about, you know, strategy and the movement and all this stuff. I've never seen that take place in a narrative feature about King.
There really haven't been a lot of narrative features about King.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about TV movies and miniseries and stuff like that as well.
Yeah,
I don't mean theatrical features because there just haven't been much.
Yeah.
But
and that's the thing. I think that people have been afraid to do movies about King because he has become so sort of
a saint.
Yeah, exactly. He's been canonized and thing. And the
this
culture,
King is not a lamb or a saint. He is a human being.
Absolutely. Yeah. And David Oyelowo, who starred in Ava DuVernay's previous film, Middle of Nowhere, which is a tiny indie. So like for her to go from that to this is a staggering ascension into like the ranks of you know, top tier filmmakers. But he's so great as King and so magnetic behind the mic. I mean, because it's no easy feat for an actor to play like one of the most charismatic public speakers of the 20th century. But then to also play that guy in a kitchen, you know, talking to his wife or talking to, you know, his friends and stuff. And the amount of detail of how they make this movie look. I mean, as I've been saying, the guy who plays Bayard Rustin has maybe 8 lines, but dang if he doesn't look exactly like Bayard Rustin.
Right.
You know, and that's just the guy I recognize. I'm sure people who really know their history and really know the players and all this are like, oh, look, and then there's Ethan, he's there. And then, you know, I mean, it's like looking at photographs, you know. But again, it feels immediate, it feels human, it feels powerful. It's extraordinary.
Apparently, some folks, and you knew these folks were going to come out of the woodwork sometime.
Oh, what now?
Are angry that LBJ is depicted as being sort of against King. When, in fact, that may not have been much the case. I would need to go back and read a book about this subject to know exactly who's right and who's wrong.
What does Robert Caro say?
But the, well, I don't know.
I trust his judgment on this. And he's the guy that knows everything about LBJ.
It would appear that the film sort of sweeps up LBJ in the tide of white voices against King.
But they make it clear that he and George Wallace are certainly not on the same page.
Exactly. So the movie may...
They don't make LBJ...
The nuances of LBJ may be lost in this movie.
They don't make him look racist. They just make him look like somebody
who... Foot dragon.
Yeah. And that he and not even political expediency, but just sort of like kind of... He has no problem with playing a long game, and King's like, we don't have time
for that. We don't have time for a long game. Yeah. So those people are mad. And they think it discredits the film entirely, and that that my new favorite word, race baiting, is what it is. Because if you talk about race, or you don't get, you know,
if someone disagrees with you about what you have to say about race,
you talk about race, you're now a race baiter. Because if we just would only stop talking about it, there would be no problems. This movie is great.
Yes.
And
I will say there were there's a little bit of a third act sag for me. I know you don't agree with me. There were a couple scenes toward the end that I thought were a little that where because the movie is so powerful and so gripping for so long, I could feel it losing me a little toward the end. But then there's the final sequence is so great that I was completely back on board. There's also a moment in there where like John Lewis starts talking about why he's doing all this, and the music swells a bit, and it's like, because the movie's been too smart for that up to that point, and it felt a bit of a gimme.
Nitpicking.
But no, absolutely nitpicking. It's one of the top 10 films of the year. Everybody should totally see this movie. It's vital, and it's exciting, and it's moving and powerful.
All right, well, your DVD pick of the week.
Wait, was that it?
We're done.
This is the five?
Yeah.
Unbroken, Sniper, Selma, Woods, and...
There's four.
No, there's five.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Pause. Okay, the other one was The Gambler, but Dave hasn't seen it yet, so we're going to do that one next time.
Yeah, like it matters.
Along with Big Eyes and Mr. Turner.
Yes.
And then we'll also be doing A Most Violent Year, yes, and Leviathan and 2 Days, 1 Night.
It's going to be so great.
Yeah. Make sure you're back for that. You don't want to miss a drop of this.
Not, no.
My DVD pick this week, as you mentioned before, is Camp, because it was the film that introduced us to Anna Kendrick, and she was singing Sondheim in it. It's also very funny, and a really charming film that I like a lot.
The Elray Network cable channel. The Robert Rodriguez operated cable channel is showing... like every Shaw Brothers kung fu movie that ever was made.
I love the name Sir Run Run Shaw.
Yeah.
Was his name Run Run?
I guess.
Okay.
It's a great name.
The Shaw Brothers, they were basically the MGM of Chopsocky movies.
Chopsocky.
It's an expression.
Indeed.
Martial arts cinema.
Amazing fighting movies. That's what we're talking about here. Tons and tons and tons of fighting.
Yes.
All fighting, all the time.
Yes.
I don't know if this is on DVD or not, but it's on the Elray Network. I watched The Kung Fu Instructor.
Mm.
1979's Kung Fu Instructor, starring T. Lung. He's a Kung Fu instructor.
And that, which is referenced in almost every scene that I saw.
And he teaches...
Kung Fu.
Kung Fu. And then there's fighting. And boy, is it good. So much good fighting.
There was quite a bit of fighting.
Swords fighting and pole fighting and...
Hooks
fighting and foot in the face.
And fighting.
And fighting. That's all there is to say about that movie. You should watch it because of fighting.
I will find a link to it somewhere. So, this is the episode where we announce...
the winners of the essay contest. Here we go.
The three essay contests.
Three essay contests. The first essay contest was to win the Apocalypse Now.
DVD.
DVD.
The Redux, the everything.
It's got the everything. It's got the old version. It's got the extended version. It's got extras. And it's not technically a box set, but it's a complete Apocalypse Now.
Yes. If you want to see Martin Sheen eating in a French farmhouse, this is the one you want.
The rules were 25 words or less.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you love war?
Yes. And who's our winner?
Well, I'm going to read you some of the runners-up.
Oh, okay.
And then I'll read you the winner. One of the runners-up is from...
Because we have such creative listeners.
One of the runners-up is from Doug Graves.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes... While the song New Year's Day brought you two to a wider audience, Two Hearts Beat as One and other tracks are why I love war.
Clever.
Christopher Hellinger writes, I love war because I wasn't there, man. That's a good one, too. Renee writes, do you want to never get old? Do you wish rules didn't apply to you? Of course you do. That is why war is great. But the winner is from our listener, whose name is Rhett. And here...
What does Rhett write?
Rhett writes...
Ruh-roh roars.
Wars waged against the white supremacist capitalist patriarchy are great. Correct.
That's the whole thing.
That is the correct answer.
Wow. Okay.
No. As for value in wars closer resembling the standard definition, they can expose power structures.
Wow.
The winner!
Rhett is a graduate student, perhaps. Just Rhett, a hunch.
Rhett gets Apocalypse Now.
All right.
Congratulations, Rhett. Then there was the Birdman poster.
Right.
The limited edition. Specially made Birdman poster. And the essay contest was, what is your favorite bird? Now, I like the minimalism of Mifo.
Mm-hmm.
Listener Mifo. His entry was, Chinese rusty-cheeked scimitar babbler.
Is that an actual bird?
I'm going to take it on fact that that is a that is a real bird. Like I say, I like that minimalist response. Because you could enter many times, mm-hmm. you could enter all three of the essay writing contests.
Yes.
Rhett, who just won the Apocalypse Now box,
mm-hmm.
is a good runner-up on the bird essay. Here it is. A robin perched next to me when I was freaking out at the bus station one day. That calmed me down a bit. Thanks, bird. this from Robert. The dodo, both flightless and ridiculous, is my favorite bird. Extinct less than 100 years after discovery, they illustrated humanity's impact on Earth. Robbie says, my favorite bird is the one that is dead, as the winged menaces bring only doom and despair and deserve their just death.
Ouch.
But the winner is Neil.
Mm-hmm.
Neil M., who writes, my favorite bird is Larry Bird, because he's basketball Jesus. My second favorite bird is the middle finger, then penguins. So you win, Neil. You win the poster.
I like Larry Bird, because I once did well in a game show, because I guessed that he
was... The one basketball player that you know.
He was the one Boston Celtic I could name.
Yeah. And then finally... The Birdman action figure.
A hot item on eBay.
Yeah.
Which is up to you. You could just keep it. That's fine, too. We're just giving it away. Beyond that, it's out of our control.
Here are the runners-up.
Okay.
And the essay contest prompt was, why am I Dave White? So great.
This should be rich.
I would like to say, because this is the truth, that more people entered this one than the others.
Because they wanted the prize.
Because I'm so great.
No.
And they all had things to say.
They all want to sell that thing on eBay. And make some money.
This very valuable thing that you can flip on eBay.
Some cash right away money, G.
If you want, yeah. Patrick says... Patrick says, my favorite bird is the peacock, because peacocks are like Dave. They have a beautiful tail. They are known for having knowledge on everything. Patrick just said I had a beautiful tail.
And it's so easy to wring their little necks.
Here's the thing about Patrick. Patrick said in his letter that he's in high school. So for a high school man to tell me I have a beautiful tail...
is a little disconcerting.
Is a little bit.
You have a good tail for radio, anyway.
Yeah. You don't win, Patrick.
Sorry.
Thank you for telling me I have a great tail.
So was that a double dip? He was entering that in two categories?
Yes.
I agree. Clever.
All right, here's a poem from Chris. Twinkle, twinkle, Mr. White, how often you show us the light. Up above other critics so high, like a velvet foghorn in the night. There's a runner-up.
Doesn't really rhyme.
It's fine. Yeah.
Oh, White, I see.
Okay. Yeah, see? Okay. Bob from Omaha apparently did a haiku.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a haiku. I'm counting on my fingers.
I saw.
The Dominator. Yet there are his subtleties. How great is Dave White?
You you're the worst.
Here's my favorite runner-up. Dave the Dominator is the greatest. In no other man does the combination of voice, body, talent, and kick-ass opinion gel so perfectly. That's from Katie. A woman,
barf,
is down for this body.
I believe Katie also appended a PS in which she said that the next essay contest should be about how awesome I am.
I don't remember
but
that.
But of course, I'm not as grossly vain as you are.
I don't have a memory
to ask
of that.
For such a thing.
But here's my favorite. Oh, wait, here's another runner-up. Sorry. This is another one from Doug. Mm-hmm. This is a clean podcast, so the words may not be spoken here.
Yeah.
These are people who want sex with me. And that's how you win this contest.
Oh.
So the winner is Sean, who says, below is
you
my...
You just implied that Sean had sex with you to win this contest.
Hang on.
Please be clear that...
Hang on.
All right, fine.
Relax. Give me a second.
I'm just trying to clear Sean's good name.
I'm fixing to explain it and clear Sean's name.
Okay, fine.
Below is my submission to the recent giveaway contest where the prompt is to say why Dave White is awesome. My wife agrees with this one. Here's what he says. Dave White is awesome because his voice is like rolling around naked on a bearskin rug in front of a roaring fireplace. You win, Sean. Heterosexual Sean.
Oh, brother.
Who's apparently has a crush on me.
Dude,
and I think I approve of that.
Who really wants that Birdman thing to sell on eBay.
How do you know that these people even care about the Birdman thing? Maybe they just want to curry my favor.
Because they're all lying. No one likes you, Dave White.
All right. Some people do like me. You, for example.
True, but I would never write an essay about
proven,
it.
Proven for years that you like me. That's on
true.
At least some level.
True.
Probably the level where I provide delicious cooked meals for you. We're done.
Really?
We are.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, golly. As always, folks, thank you for listening. This has been a terrific year for us. We introduced merch.
Yes.
And we were doing the extra episodes. And we'll be recording our next one for the Poseidon Adventure very soon.
Yes.
For New Year's.
Yes.
And the show has grown, and it's mainly been through you guys. We appreciate everybody who posts the links and tells your friends and talks about us online and says, hey, check out this show. You might like it.
I do love it when they do that.
That is how people find us. So keep it up in 2015.
Keep going to the produce section.
Yes, and talking about us next to the oranges.
Telling people.
It helps a lot. So we genuinely, sincerely appreciate that. And we look forward to more, wonderful
money.
Interactions with you in 2015.
More money.
So anyway, in the meantime, we will be back next week. But you can check out ChristyLemire.com. Go to, over at Wolf Pop, where they've got the Rotten Tomatoes podcast and Malton on Movies and our friend Amy Nicholson on The Canon. And then, of course, there is the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, the Schmoes Know, the Brett Easton Ellis podcast, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Criterion cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Film Spotting SVU, Podcrash, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel. I have fallen behind in posting old episodes on our YouTube channel because I currently can't find my hard drive where they all live. My hard drive used to live on my desk and never move, and now I have this little one that I can take around with me, and so, of course, now I can't find the thing. But once I find it, I will add more. Subscribe to the show if you haven't already on iTunes, and if you have already subscribed, go back to iTunes and leave us a nice review. It does help people find the show. You can also stream us at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com and leave us positive feedback there as well. You can also stream the show on a lovely little app on our Facebook page, which you should totally like. And please also join our Facebook group where our listeners talk to each other about movies and we occasionally chime in. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. GetGlue.com apparently is going away after December 31st, so don't
worry. What happened?
The whole thing is gone.
But what's going to become?
Nothing. They pulled it was Get Glue, and then it was TV Tag, and now it's nothing. So they're pulling up stakes, so never mind.
Huh.
But thank you to everybody, to Steven, and to all the people who left comments there. And of course, oh God, why am I blanking on our most devoted listener who was always leaving comments there? Hold on, this is embarrassing. Matthew, God, I'm an idiot. Sorry, I've not slept a lot, or I've been sleeping too much, or something. It's the holidays, you know. Anyway, drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with your questions, your comments. The contest is over, but, you know, we always still love to hear from you. And that's, of course, where you can PayPal us if you want to hear any of our special episodes. The holidays are over, but you might still want to listen to White Christmas or Santa Claus. Or perhaps you would prefer to curl up with Clue or Two for the Road or Josie and the Pussycats or The Apple. Again, coming up will be Poseidon Adventure, and we'll let you know when that one goes live. We are out of t-shirts, pretty much, yes.
It's like, we have a couple XLs left. I think we have one small left.
Okay,
so we have like three or four left.
If you want to get your hands on any of those, PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. The t-shirts are $20. The commentaries are $1.99. And there will be more exciting merch opportunities in the year to come. And golly, I guess we're done. So Happy New Year, everybody. We will check back with you in January. And looking forward to seeing you then.
Oh, it's my turn to say something. Goodbye.